Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. The usual two segments lined up. First, in a few minutes, we'll speak with Alfredo Corchado, who is the Mexico bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News, who is actually on a Nieman Fellowship at Harvard this year. Talk to him about what is going on with all this drug gang violence. There's certainly a media hysteria about what's going on in the Southwest. A lot of killing going on in Mexico. What's behind this? How serious is it? What does it all mean? We'll hear from Alfredo Corchado on that topic. And then towards the bottom of the hour, perhaps a little before that, we'll be joined in the studio by Justin Fox, who is a correspondent for Time magazine, but most relevantly, the author of a book called The Myth of the Rational Market, A History of Risk, Reward, and Delusion on Wall Street, a kind of intellectual history of the notion of market efficiency and how that got translated into a market fundamentalism that now has suffered some severe blows, at least in the theoretical realm and in the financial realm, but we'll see. It hasn't really suffered that many in the political realm yet, but we shall see about that. Okay, so some words in the economic news. We learned on Thursday morning that first-time claims for unemployment insurance, that sensitive and timely indicator of the state of the job market, that's filed by people who've just lost their jobs and are signing up for benefits, that fell by a significant 24,000 last week to the lowest level since January. The number, while still high, has come down at an annualized rate of over 20% over the last 3 months. And the downtrend in the year-to-year changes in this measure, which peaked in February, now looks to be accelerating. As I mentioned here before, well before hotshot economist Robert Gordon made headlines the other week for saying it, such movements in the yearly change in the unemployment insurance claims figures have in the past been reliable pointers to the coming end of recessions. So that is what that measure is behaving like now. We shall see if it follows the path it has in the past. Some caveats here. The first-time unemployment claims figures, while coming down, are still quite high, meaning that the job market still stinks. It's just getting a little less stinky. And so-called continuing claims, that is the number of people continuing to draw benefits, as opposed to those just applying for the first time, that figure is still rising. The job market has clearly not turned around by any means. That point was made clear last Friday by the release of the May employment figures for the U.S. KPFA and web listeners have already heard this, but the WBAI audience hasn't, so I will give a brief recap. Employers shed 345,000 jobs in May. That was received by some of the more excitable sorts as great news, since it's a bit more than half the recent average. That's what passes for good news these days. The losses are only half as bad as they've been recently, but it's still a wretched number. Total job losses in this recession so far are now more than a percentage point greater than the 1981-82 downturn and more than twice as high as the 1973-75 affair. These are both seen as very, very deep recessions, and so we've now surpassed those, and in the case of the 70s one, by a considerable margin. Hourly earnings for the private sector worker barely grew in the month of May, and the work week tied its record low, which was set just a few months ago. Putting all this together, the decline in the work week, in employment, and the weakness in hourly earnings, that means that household incomes remain under enormous pressure. And since credit is hard to come by, this is all very bad news for people trying to make ends meet and for an economy dependent on high levels of mass consumption. Those numbers come from a survey of employers. The corresponding survey of households was considerably more downbeat. The unemployment rate rose sharply to 9.4%, its highest level since 1983. The so-called U6 rate, which adds in people who've given up the job search as hopeless and those working part-time who want full-time work but can't find it, which is a much better measure of the actual level of employment deprivation than the official rate, that rose 0.6 of a point to 16.4%, very high level. On Friday morning, the Federal Reserve released its quarterly flow of funds account, which take the measure of the financial status of households, businesses, and governments in the U.S. It's a complement to the more familiar national income accounts, the centerpiece of which is GDP. These measure the production of goods and services and incomes earned in that production, but they don't cover finances at all, things, that is, like debts and assets. I didn't have the time to do a full analysis, but a couple of quick highlights from the household accounts. The net worth of households, their assets, that is, things like houses, bank deposits, stock and mutual fund holdings, and so on, less liabilities, debts like mortgages and credit cards, net worth fell for the seventh consecutive quarter. The major culprit, of course, was the decline in house prices, which are now down for nine consecutive quarters. But the value of household financial assets, like mutual funds and pension funds, are also in a persistent decline. As with many things, though, the rate of decline seems to be slowing. Still, the hit to household net worth, down 14% for the year ending in the first quarter after adjusting for inflation, is only slightly less bad than the record-setting 16% hit at the end of 2008. In the bad recession of the mid-1970s, net worth was down a mere 12% of the previous record. It also looks like people are borrowing less. As I said before, consumer credit, mainly credit cards, is contracting, a very rare event in modern economic history. But it also looks like the process is just beginning. Households are in debt up to their ears and their assets are weighed down, so the prudent thing to do would be for people to stop borrowing and start saving. But while that makes sense for individuals, it's not good news for the broad economy, which depends on high levels of borrowing and spending. I think that it's likely that this new prudence will last for a while and will be one of the things weighing on prospects for economic recovery. That plus the unwillingness of employers to hire. As I've been saying, while it looks like the rate of job destruction is slowing, the rate of job creation has yet to pick up. And that may well last into 2010. Finally, I've been focusing in these opening commentaries mainly on the U.S. economy because I live here and that's what I know best. But I should get out a little more. One point that's important to make is that while the current economic crisis started in the U.S. a couple of years ago, we are not the hardest hit region in the world. Parts of Europe are taking major hits, especially the periphery, like what wits on Wall Street are now calling the PIGS, Portugal, Ireland, Greece, and Spain. I don't know of any clever acronym for the troubled economies of Eastern Europe, but things are quite bad there too, especially in the Baltics. The European Central Bank just lent 3 billion euros to the Swedish Central Bank to cover any losses that country's banking sector might suffer because of exposure to its eastern neighbors, especially Latvia. Latvia's economy has fallen off a cliff, and it has huge foreign debts. The IMF is on the scene with its usual medicine of deep budget cuts and austerity for all. Note that when rich countries get into trouble, they pump up spending to counteract the slump. That's what we've been doing. When smaller, poorer countries get into trouble, Dr. IMF applies the bloodletting leeches. This isn't unlike what they've done to Iceland. For a while, I thought that the IMF might be gentler to white people than it has been in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. But it hasn't. It'll bleed anyone, unless they're big and rich. Sweden's banks are probably safe, but the people of Latvia are going to have to punch some new holes in their belts to tighten them further. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk with Alfredo Corchado. And that, the Clash's drug stabbing time from long, long ago, perhaps tasteless setup for this next segment. And we are now joined on the line by Alfredo Corchado, who is the Mexico bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News and who is now at Harvard for this academic year on his Nieman Fellowship. Welcome to Behind the News, Alfredo Corchado.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, so we've been hearing a lot. The cable TV stations are going crazy covering the influx of Mexican drug gangs into the southwestern U.S. and perhaps deeper into the country. We're hearing stories of terrible violence along the border. How much, how serious, and how worried should we be?
What is a serious problem? Perhaps they're using the wrong term and saying it's a spillover of violence. I think it's more of a spillover of the violence in Mexico. It is having on the U.S. side. I mean, you are seeing a spillover of people leaving Mexico. I think the role of the United States has been much more exposed than in the past. But to say that that the same kind of violence is coming over to the United States, I think that's kind of overstating the situation.
Well, I guess that it sort of feeds into hysteria about immigration in general, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, we haven't really seen the kind of violence that that's happening in Mexico, the beheadings, the gruesome kind of violence, that hasn't happened yet. But especially in a place like El Paso, Texas, you are seeing an increased amount of people, middle class, the lower class, who are fleeing for the U.S. side. We're saying, enough is enough. We want security for our families, and you are seeing. Whether it's El Paso, whether it's Laredo, whether it's San Antonio, San Diego, many more people who are seeking, if not asylum, they're seeking security.
And now let's talk some about Mexico. How violent is, how bad are things there?
Well, we haven't seen this kind of violence in Mexico, in a long time. And I'm not overstating this if I say that this kind of violence has not been seen in Mexico since the 1910 revolution. It is a pretty bad situation, and it's gone from bad to worse. I think last year was a record-breaking year. We thought, many of us thought that this would be a better year. That hasn't happened. I mean, it's on pace to break last year's record of killings.
Well, are the gangs killing each other principally, or are they actually killing regular people too?
No, I mean, it's not really random violence. It's very specific violence. It's rival drug cartels. What you have is a war between, in this case, the Sinaloa cartel from northern Mexico versus the Goth cartel versus the Juarez cartel. These are all regional cartels in Mexico, and they're going at it. They're fighting for the lucrative routes that head into the United States. But it's not random violence where people are saying, okay, we're going to kill this American or we're going to kill that Mexican. I mean, it's very specific, very, very targeted.
And what drugs are they moving?
Cocaine, marijuana, cocaine from Colombia, marijuana from Mexico. It's an insatiable demand in the United States. I mean, that really hasn't changed yet. It's still very much the American consumer market. In many ways, it's what's creating this whole violence in Mexico.
And how did these gangs grow so to such proportions? We were used to hearing the sort of things about Colombia. This is something of an innovation to see violence on this scale in Mexico. How did this happen?
Well, for a long time, you had the government and the cartels kind of had an understanding and agreement. There was if you want to call it a pact. In the early, 2006, 2005, when President Calderon came to office in December 2006, decided to crack down on the cartels and decided that the cartels were really getting out of hand. They were controlling too much of the Mexican territory. So the Calderon administration decided to crack down. They sent out military all over all over Mexico, and thus it became a war. It became what we see today, a lot more violence.
And how deeply are the police involved in the drug trade in Mexico?
I think that's really the critical problem here, is that the crackdown also exposed the level of corruption within the Mexican government, especially law enforcement. It's corruption that, whether it's municipal police, the state police, the federal police, corruption, it's all parts of the Mexican government. And, oftentimes it looks like a war within the government itself.
Well, I imagine the police are not very highly paid, so it's pretty easy to buy them off, isn't it?
Incredibly easy. I think the average pay is something like $300 a month. So it's not difficult for the cartels to come and say, hey, you want to make a little more money? Here's some cash. Or if you don't, you know, if you don't take the offer, we'll kill your family, or we'll kill your loved one. So it's very difficult for the cops to, you know, not to be part of the corruption. And by force or by, well, because they want to.
Yeah. How much is this tied to troubles in the broader Mexican economy? I would imagine that the Mexican economy has not exactly been thriving in recent years. Have the drugs, drug gangs been taking advantage of that?
Hasn't been thriving. You're right about that. And I think one of the biggest concerns is that with the economy working as it has, there are more younger people who I think rather become part of a cartel or become hitmen for a cartel rather than immigrate illegally to the United States. It's much more lucrative to become a cartel member than it is to try to come to the United States and go through the hassle of crossing the border. That's something that I think has changed a lot in Mexico, and that's something that really alarms Mexicans today. It's the whole cultural impact of the drug violence and what it's having on young Mexicans themselves.
Well, also, it's harder to get the American economy is in recession. It's harder to find a job. The construction industry, which employed a lot of Mexican migrants, is you know, just completely fallen apart. So, and then there's this nasty turn against immigrants in the political culture. Well, what's the impact of that been in Mexico?
There's a saying in Mexico these days, in some northern parts of the country, that says, "I'd rather live like a king for 10 years, for 5 years, than to live like a Knox for 50 years, meaning I'd rather work for a cartel, make a lot of money. You know, it might cost my life, but I'm going to help my family along the way. Going to the United States is so much of a hassle, it's so dangerous to cross the border. And even if you get across the border, you might not find a job because of the recession.
So has this led to people returning to Mexico from the United States? Can we tell?
Well, we have seen a number of people return to Mexico, especially in recent months. I mean, we haven't seen a number of people leaving for the United States as we have historically. Illegal immigration has slowed down, in part because, I mean, not just because of the lucrative drug trade, but I think more importantly because, as you were saying, the recession in the United States. You are seeing people who rather try to, you know, make ends meet in Mexico, and it's very, very difficult. I think what's worrisome is the months to come when the economy worsens in Mexico. I mean, that's really the big question mark is how will Mexico handle this?
Yeah, well, the United States has been in recession for a year and a half. Has this dragged Mexico down with it?
It has to some extent. Just recently, the Economic Secretary announced that I think inflation would rise a bit more in the months to come, and that is leading to many worries across Mexico.
And now the American government has been talking in terms of Mexico. I think the national security establishment has been saying that Mexico is on the verge of being a failed state. We're hearing comparisons to Pakistan. Is there anything like that?
Not at all. And I think in that sense, the Pentagon, which I think was the first one to come out and said that, really overstate the problem. And unfortunately, as you were saying, the 24-hour news cycle got a wind of it and became a big story. I mean, you know, what Mexico is going through today is not different from what the United States went through a century ago or what the Italians have gone through. It's a big problem, but I think Mexicans also kind of see that at least now the Mexican government is trying to deal with something that's been a historical problem. And corruption has always been there. It's just gotten worse. So, you know, is it a failed state? No, it's not a failed state, but it exposes, I think, how weak the institutions are in Mexico, and they are very weak. It's going to require a lot of institutional building by the Mexicans themselves, and even through this whole Mérida initiative that the United States is focused on now, the $1.4 billion Mérida initiative. It costs for the United States to focus a lot of their attention, a lot of their efforts on helping Mexico strengthen the rule of law, et cetera.
Well, talk a bit about that initiative. What's that all about?
It's a $1.5 billion initiative where the United States is sending they're helping Mexico with training of the military, helping build the institutions. They're sending equipment like helicopters to Mexico. All the effort to try to fight drug cartels and to try to fight, try to help Mexico become a stronger country as far as institutions are concerned. 90% of all crimes, more than 90% of all crimes, are never really resolved in Mexico, and that's a reflection of the weak institutions the country has.
Now, in the past, or elsewhere in Latin America, some of these military aid programs have resulted in horrendous human rights abuses. Do you think Mexico is in line for something like that?
That's the concern. The more the military gets involved, the more the you are seeing an increase in human rights abuses, and that is a concern. I think among a lot of U.S. congressmen is how do we ensure that Mexico does not have the same problems that other Latin American countries have had, like Colombia. That is a huge concern, and we are unfortunately seeing some of that happen in places like Ciudad Juarez and. Other Mexican cities like Tijuana, et cetera.
And is the army as corrupt as the police force is?
Not as corrupt, but I think there is some corruption, and I think there's much more corruption than the Mexican government or the Mexican people want to believe, but there is corruption. I mean, we're talking about very powerful cartels, you know. There's a lot of money being thrown around. Some estimate says it's, you know, as much as $500 million is being spent a year by the cartels to anybody, whether it's the military, the government, or the police forces.
Well, and finally, when NAFTA came into effect back in 1994, there was a lot of talk about how Mexico was about to join the first world. That doesn't seem to have panned out, does it?
Well, it hasn't happened, I think, the way both governments said it would. But, I mean, I think the northern parts of Mexico, you have seen quite an improvement. Mexico has had some tough economic times, and I think, you know, had it not been for NAFTA, it would have been a lot worse. It hasn't been the panacea that that the Mexican president at the time or the American government was saying. I mean, you go to southern Mexico, and there's an incredible amount of poverty in that area. There's still an incredible amount of migration. But NAFTA not been around, I think today, you know, you would see a much weaker Mexico.
All right. Oh, I've been speaking with Alfredo Corchado. Thank you for joining us. Alfredo Corchado is the Mexico Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News, who is at Harvard this academic year on a Nieman Fellowship. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about the myth of the rational market. And that was 10cc, the Wall Street Shuffle, a song I played too many times setting up a Wall Street segment, but I don't know. I don't think people take notes in these things. So I should say, we're coming on the half-hour mark, so I should say this is WBAI in New York, 99.5 on your FM dial and on the web at WBAI.org. If you gave during our recent fund drive, thank you very much, and don't forget to pay your pledge. And if you didn't, you can always go visit our website and hit the donate button, WBAI.org, and we will welcome your cash at any time of the year. And thanks to those of you who did pledge during the fundraising drive and made it a success, there is a new spirit of revival around here, and it feels good to come by. It wasn't feeling so good a few months ago, so thank you. All right. We're now joined in the studio by Justin Fox, who is a business and economics columnist for Time Magazine and author of their blog, The Curious Capitalist, which is at time.com/curiouscapitalist. But the reason he's here is that he's got a new book out called The Myth of the Rational Market, The History of Risk, Reward, and Delusion on Wall Street, just published by Harper. Welcome to Behind the News.
Thanks for having me.
So certainly a lot of stuff for a business and economics columnist to cover these days, isn't there?
Yeah, a bit too much.
Well, you know, here we are. Wall Street has made a big mess, of the world economy. Certainly some of its colleagues around the world, like the City of London, certainly had a hand in it. But what we think of as Wall Street finance really now just looking like a big accident. There were a lot of folks who thought that they could master the whole thing with rationality, that it all made sense, right?
Right. It was, and it's a beautifully simple theory of how markets work, is that they work all the time. And, I mean, that's I ever since I started writing about business, which was, I guess, about 15 years ago, I was always – I was initially kind of convinced by it because this was the mid-90s when everything was sort of working and Wall Street seemed to know what it was doing. But I realized over the course of a few years that just a lot – in a lot of cases, the world didn't work anything like the basic efficient market theories of finance. And I didn't really invest – I didn't realize that there were also a lot of finance professors who had realized this and economists. And that's something I finally noticed. It took me a bit longer than it did you. I was just reading your book Wall Street in the – train in the subway on the way down, but it didn't hit me until about 2002, and that's what led me to write this book.
Well, certainly the Times are a little friendlier to that kind of argument now than they were when I published that in 1996, 97. It was a very lonely position to stake
right
out at that point because everybody believed in the market. And, you know, that was a time when there was just no visible criticism of the thing. It was the perfect mechanism and just had to get with the program. But now, things are a little more complicated, it looks like. But let's review the history of how we got here. You open the book with Irving Fisher, who is, of course, a very, very distinguished economist, was certainly one of the more famous members of his profession, but who's now probably best remembered for one of the worst prophecies of all time, saying in 1929 that the stock market had reached a
permanently high plateau.
Yes, and poor guy is
now – we should sing it in unison.
Poor guy is now remembered for that remark, but he did a lot of other things as well. And I didn't know that his book was stolen. So tell us the story of the book, the manuscript that was stolen and what he rewrote.
Well, yeah, he was an absent-minded guy. He was a professor. And he had written this manuscript, his first really major economic book, in 1905, and he was standing in a phone booth at the old Grand Central Depot, and somebody was talking on the phone, and somebody stole it from between his legs. And he had not backed up his hard drive, and so he had to write the whole book again. And one of the things that just struck – I mean, Fisher just kept having all these things happen to him. His house burned down. He had almost died of tuberculosis, and he'd keep coming back. And he sort of did after 1929 too. He did some of his best work. And also sort of started the ball rolling to this takeover of economics by math majors in the early 30s. Even while he was totally discredited in the larger world, he was helping pull some levers to get the new world that would really flower in the 50s and 60s going.
But he did write that classic paper, The Debt Deflation Theory.
Right.
Of Great
he also did in the early
1933, 30s. 1933, which right. was still worth reading now. I think Ben Bernanke probably has had about his bedside.
A lot of people have been reading it lately, yeah.
What did Fisher do? How did he? What were his mathematical innovations?
Well, he was one of the early equilibrium economists who had put together these nice theories of how everything, the invisible hand, made the economy work. He wasn't the first. The first were all Europeans, but Fisher was the first American who became involved in that. And then I guess what drew me to him, and I can't even remember quite how it happened, but I started reading this book that he had lost and rewrote, The Nature of Capital and Income. And there are just all these chapters in it that seem like a slightly less formal version of a modern finance textbook. It's pretty much all the teachings of modern finance out of MIT and the University of Chicago originally, but really taught at every business school in the land, were all there in Irving Fisher in 1905. And so I suddenly realized that, okay, maybe that permanently high plateau thing, because among economists, I mean, I talked to Milton Friedman about this, and he sort of dismissed, yeah, Fisher was a little goofy sometimes, but, you know, his big mistake was he didn't know what a bad job the Federal Reserve would do in the 30s.
Which, of course, is Friedman's theory of why the Depression happened, was it's all the Fed's fault.
Nothing
intrinsic to capitalism, but it was just bad policy by the state that
did it all. And I guess the problem with that argument is just that it seems like Fisher really did, and he went back and forth on this. Initially, when he was a graduate student, in his earliest work, he was this believer in perfectly rational markets. And then there was this big inflation in the late 1800s, early 1900s, caused by some gold discoveries and better gold mining technology. And he sort of watched the impact that had on the real economy, how people didn't really deal with price changes very well. And he did, he became a little looser, and that's where his monetary economics came from to a certain extent. But something in the 20s, I guess it was the classic thing, like the way it was in the 1990s, things were going so well that I think he shoved any questions he had about the market's rationality to the back of his head and just figured it's all working now.
Yeah, well, the language was almost identical in the 20s and then the 90s. It was a new era. And,
right.
It was just we'd solved the economic problem. Just remarkable parallels between that. And
yeah.
Also the 1890s, we heard the same thing. It was remarkable.
And we had all these financial innovations that were spreading risk better. I mean, that was with Fisher's writing is just so remarkable that he was even using that kind of language in the late 20s. I mean, he was writing about mutual funds, basically. So it's pretty primitive technology by modern standards, but
yeah,
still.
Well, but stepping back to the great inflation at the turn of the century, according to a lot of economists, that people should be able to see through those things.
Right.
That they shouldn't be so bamboozled by price changes because they should really understand the real values underlying and the relative prices don't change and such. So, that, you know, the inflation is just an illusion, basically. But obviously, it really has an effect in the way people think and feel and act.
Well, and that's one place where both Fisher and Milton Friedman weren't totally doctrinaire. They were willing to admit that. And it was kind of strange that they picked this one area where people weren't quite rational in their financial decisions, but they were supposed to be rational in everything else. But it was still, compared with what was to come at Chicago in the 70s with the efficient market hypothesis and with rational expectations, Friedman and Fisher come across as reasonable moderates on a lot of this stuff.
Well, okay, let's make that journey towards Chicago, which, of course, is the Vatican of this whole enterprise.
Right.
Harry Markowitz, who is he and what did he do?
Harry Markowitz was this very young grad student. It was some special program at Chicago where you'd finish up the undergrad in 2 years and go straight on into grad school. Working on his PhD at the University of Chicago and at this thing called the Coles Commission, which Irving Fisher had helped get off the ground, which was bankrolled by a guy who his family was one of the big owners of the Chicago Tribune. And it was sort of the first redoubt of mathematical economics. It was initially out in Colorado Springs and then moved to Chicago in the 40s, I guess. So he was surrounded by all of these sort of the most mathematically inclined economists there were. Several of them would come over from Europe. And also people who had spent the war, World War II, using their statistics knowledge to do kind of impressive things. Like Friedman spent a couple of years helping figure out how many pieces you wanted an artillery shell to fragment into to maximize, I want to say risk and reward because that's what Markowitz did, but it was the same idea. It was to maximize your likelihood of hitting, to balance likelihood of hitting with power of the impact. And so what Markowitz did is sort of applied these same ideas to stock picking.
I remember when I was doing my research for Wall Street, I was struck by the repeated appearance of a military connection in a lot of this research,
right.
A lot of military funding that actually turned into modern finance theory.
Yeah, RAND was a real base of a lot of this stuff as well. And Markowitz went to work at RAND as soon as he got his PhD.
And so what was his major contribution then?
Well, it's seen as, I mean, I guess his biggest contribution was he was the first person to bring quantitative mathematical techniques to finance, to the stock market. Before then, the field of finance was this very anecdotal. It was at business schools. It was very much you'd tell stories about what companies did. And Markowitz was the very beginning of this more systematic view. And I mean, I defend Markowitz because there are those who think Markowitz is evil, and he's just this very pleasant, not all that old man, because he wrote this stuff in the early 50s. He was only about 20 years old, who was simply, he was a computer geek, and he was looking for a way to apply all this stuff he'd learned in statistics class to something practical. And he picked the stock market, did that.
Was he hoping to make money, or did he just find it an interesting problem?
I think he really would have loved it if he could have persuaded people on Wall Street in the 50s to take up his ideas. And he tried a little bit. He came back and he had initially written this journal article about portfolio selection. He went back and wrote a whole book about it a few years later. And he really thought that he was giving practical advice. But the funny thing that happened is, and he was perfectly willing to work with people on Wall Street who didn't think the market was always right and were trying to outsmart the market, doing whatever. But what ended up happening is none of them wanted what he was selling. And what finally happened is it was only in the 1960s with the rise of all these scholars who believed markets were almost perfectly random and rational that the Markowitz approach really took off. And it took off in a more doctrinaire fashion than he probably ever would have wanted it to.
And Wall Street, it should be said, in the 1950s was a very sleepy place.
Right.
People made nice livings, but they were not raking it in. And in any ways, like the way they have been in the last couple of decades, trading volumes were low. It hadn't really recovered from the depression.
Well, and one of the fascinating things to me that I sort of realized late in writing this book is that environment created a reasonably rational financial market. That sort of sleepy, slow-moving environment delivered results that, to people looking at the markets in the late 50s and early 60s, seemed to fit well with theories that the market was rational.
It also had very little effect in the real economy in those days,
right,
unlike what it would come to do in the 80s and 90s. Okay, I'm talking to Justin Fox, author of the book The Myth of the Rational Market, A History of Risk, Reward, and Delusion on Wall Street, just published by Harper. And let's move on to Paul Samuelson, who... famous as an author of an economics textbook, thought to be something of a liberal, but he was a major contributor to the evolution of financial theory too, right?
Right. Well, he was the great – I mean, he was Irving Fisher's successor, is the great mathematical economist and proselytizer of these things. And Samuelson's fascinating because in his theoretical work, he's so doctrinaire. And then as soon as he would start talking about it in class or in the popular media, he was very loose. He'd say, okay, we have all these theories, but, you know, this one might actually apply and this one might not. But I think the impact of somebody like that is always it's his formal mathematical economics that ends up having much more impact than what he happened to say as a throwaway thing in class. And so I think Samuelson is generally a pretty reasonable guy, ended up leading and having a lot of students who took things in what I would think is kind of extreme directions.
And he was famous for a little paper, right, on the forecastability or predictability.
Right. Well, he basically made the point, and this point had been made by others before, but again, he put it all in equations and made it formal that a rational stock market would be an unpredictable one, which when you think about it makes sense if the stock market is at all times rationally looking at where things stand right now, you shouldn't be able to predict where it's going to go next unless you know what the news is going to be next. So it's a reasonable point. And again, Samuelson at the end of this paper writes, I'm not saying actual markets are rational. I'm not saying any of this really – I'm not saying speculation's good. I'm not saying markets are good. It's just this nice mathematical thing I did. But very quickly, 1,000 miles away in Chicago, this got turned into – hey, the market's almost perfect.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Well, first of all, there's Modigliani and Miller and their classic paper, which, as I recall, the American Economic Review had a real typographical challenge setting the type for the article because they hadn't seen so much math before in an economics paper. And, of course, now it's all math, but
yep.
Then it wasn't. What did they have to say?
Well, they were trying to solve this problem for corporate planners, executives, which is basically how do you decide whether investment's worth making or not. And what everyone always struggled with is you'd want to do something that you think would get you an investment return that's more than your cost of capital. And it's just, it turns out the cost of capital for a company is kind of hard to figure out because you've got both bonds and you've got debt. And so it was this puzzle that people wrote lots of papers and finance journals about for years. And the practical thing people would do is just look at the interest rate you paid on your bonds and add a couple percentage points. But actually getting too much into the details of that messes it up, because really Modigliano and Miller never actually solved that problem. But in the course of trying to solve it, they came to they just came up with these grand sweeping statements about markets and companies' relationship to them. And one of them was that, well, basically what it was is that the only thing that mattered was whatever would increase your stock price was good. And since markets were rational, then anything you did with your debt or equity or whether you paid dividends or not shouldn't matter to the stock price, because investors could see that it was just the value of the corporation and the cash flows out of it that mattered, and they would eventually get their money one way or the other.
And because the stock market is wise and rational, if the stock price goes up, the company's doing the right thing. If it goes down, it's doing the wrong thing, and problem solved.
Right? So you get, you sort of get the doctrine of shareholder value out of their papers as well. And there's this funny point in one of, they had two big papers, one in the 50s, one in 62 or 63, and in one of them they talk about, we realize there have been bubbles and crashes and all sorts of things in the past, but we just think for the purposes of talking about long-term behavior in the stock market, it's okay to assume that it's rational. So, and you saw that in a lot of the 50s and 60s work. You know, we know the world isn't really like this, but let's model it this way. And then it's just fascinating to watch those little caveats disappear over the next 20 years in most of the work that was done on this
stuff.
All right,
then Gene Fama is a name that contributed a bit to that deification of the market.
Yeah, and in a way, I think there were other people at Chicago in the 60s who were even more enthusiastic about the whole efficient market idea, and Fama was just trying to codify it, say, okay, what exactly are we trying to say here? And so he was the first to start using the term efficient market, when other people had initially just been talking about random walks, and he kind of moved it into this broader discussion of A, whether anybody could beat the market, and B, whether that meant prices were right. And so he presented this paper at the 1969 annual meeting of the American Finance Association on the efficient market, dubbing this thing the efficient market hypothesis, and basically saying what it consisted of and how it could be tested.
So we should talk about what they mean by efficiency in
right.
that sense, because it doesn't mean what people think the word efficient means necessarily in the colloquial sense, or what an engineer would mean by efficient. But we went from this realm where you're saying the market is not predictable, it's kind of random, to saying that it's efficient. There's a leap there and many other leaps beyond that. But what do they mean by this doctrine of efficiency?
It seems pretty clear what they meant in the 60s and 70s and 80s was that the market was rational. The market was right. Prices were right in some fundamental way. And they never say they were exactly right. They would fluctuate around their fundamental values was a common term. I mean, what's interesting now is I would go over the past few years, I've visited various business schools, and I had this one really weird experience at the business school at Duke, where I go walking down the halls, meeting all the finance professors, explaining to them I'm working on this. I'd tell them all I'm working on a book about the rise and fall of the efficient market hypothesis. And half of them would say, what a great idea for a book. And the other half would say, what fall of the efficient market hypothesis? But then when you talk to these people, they weren't crazy. They just had basically defined efficiency down over the past 15 or 20 years. And they no longer, all they were saying again is that the market is unpredictable. In terms of the academic work that's out there on the efficient market, that's what it's been reduced to. Nobody's claiming in the academic journals to have any evidence that the market is right.
Well, part of the doctrine is that the market prices, stocks, exchange, foreign exchange, whatever, fully reflect all available information. Which, in some sense, is true. Obviously,
right.
You know, it's people are buying and selling based on their opinions and their feelings, and the market prices reflect that balance of forces. But what about the quality of that information? Do they really know what's going on? Can they see the future, or are they just reacting to the present and the recent past?
Right. I mean, first of all, there's this whole issue of predicting the future is just difficult. So even if it is the best possible forecast, it's going to be wrong a lot. But I think the more fundamental thing is there are clearly these waves of optimism and pessimism and of credit expansion and credit contraction that just are not even part of this whole discussion if you're using these rational market, efficient market models to look at the world. And that's just clearly this huge loss that you have to talk. Sometimes you have to talk about those other things too. And to me, that's there are lots of models of how the world works, and I think there's not any right one. And I don't think all of this stuff is crazy that these people did at Chicago. I just think at a certain point it made them stop paying attention to some other really interesting explanations for how the world works.
So boil down with the theory that emerged out of Chicago or that dominated Chicago. The market is always right is the colloquial version of it. But what were they actually arguing?
Well, one was this sort of political ideological argument that, yeah, financial markets are right. And therefore, we should just let them go and do what they're going to do because they'll do the right thing. And then the other is just you can do all sorts of great stuff if you start with the starting point that prices in the market, asset prices, are something you can rely on. You can build all sorts of theories of options pricing, derivatives pricing on top of that. And you can just generally build this really convenient structure of finance upon that basis that means you don't really have to pay attention to dirty data like GDP or unemployment or anything like that. I mean, there was this hilarious moment in the mid-'80s when Bob Shiller, who was one of the first real critics, part of this new generation of critics of this whole idea, he had written a few papers basically just pointing out that stock prices were a whole lot more volatile than any measure of corporate reality. Earnings, dividends, whatever else. And there were a few other people working the same vein too. And Robert Merton later went on to win a Nobel right before his hedge fund tanked in the 90s. His defense was, and it was interesting, Merton was one of the few people who was just willing to call it the rationality hypothesis. And his defense for it is, you know, financial data is the cleanest, best data in the world. And if it doesn't agree with the messy data you get from corporate earnings reports or government economic data, how are we sure that it's the financial data that's wrong and not the other data? Which is this great way of twisting around the world. And at some level, there's some point. I mean, obviously, real economic data is always flawed. But it was just this bizarre worldview of nothing mattered but prices. And I guess what it seems to me happened in the 90s is even at Chicago, there were all of these younger professors challenging these things. And then Fama, in sort of a wonderful late career track, doing all this research to show that he'd been wrong. He was never able to admit in any of these papers that, oh, I was wrong. But he was willing to keep testing what he'd proposed in the 70s. And he kept failing the tests, his hypothesis. But even while this was going on campus, these ideas were even more powerful in society than they'd been since the 20s.
Yeah, because this contributed a lot to the broad public notion that the market is always right.
Right.
Because there was this academic pedigree for this very political notion, which of course turned out to be, I think almost everyone will now admit, had some flaws.
Yeah.
But you mentioned Robert Shiller, so let's talk a little bit about him. He discovered that market prices were far more volatile than underlying reality, corporate dividends or profits. And so that shouldn't happen if the world were fully rational, the markets were fully rational. But Shiller introduced notions of mob psychology, which is and part of the challenge to market efficiency are these folks who are introducing notions of human psychology or crowd psychology into a profession that doesn't like to talk about such irrational things.
Yeah, and what's kind of interesting, though, is that there is this whole rise of behavioral economics and, to a smaller extent, behavioral finance. But Shiller's actually not that involved in that because that's all these people trying to build from individual traits to come up with models of larger market behavior, whereas Shiller just keeps it really simple and says, you know, we have herds. People go on these frenzies as groups. It's crowd psychology, and it's not based on sort of micro foundations. And one of the interesting things about economics since the 70s is it's really hard to make any kind of argument unless you can come up with the microeconomic foundations for why it is so. And that's been one of the problems that this whole idea of behavior. So basically, Shiller's work on crowd psychology gets almost no attention within the academy. And all these people who are trying to build micro foundations based on certain observed behavioral quirks, basically just haven't been able to come up with a convincing explanation of market phenomena using that. So it's all in this big muddle at the moment.
Well, it's interesting. Wall Street is a kind of a divided mind on this stuff because, you know, certainly a lot of Wall Street people bought all this math and tried trading on it. And you mentioned Merton's hedge fund, long-term capital management, blowing up because the math didn't work. But there are a lot of – the one side of Wall Street was very loyal to and put this into practice. But on the other side, there are a lot of folks like, you know, George Soros or Warren Buffett who don't buy this nonsense at all, and they're enormously successful people. What about the practical divisions on Wall Street over this kind of notion of market rationality?
Well, and Soros and Buffett are actually exceptions to this, but there are a lot of other people on Wall Street who see their job as beating the market all the time and think they can. But at the same time, in any macro discussion, say, oh, well, the market is the best way to steer capital and we need to just let the market
well,
do all
what
those it
other, wants. All the other idiots can't beat the market, but I can, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, maybe that's what it is. Whereas Soros and Buffett are at least willing to sort of draw some of the logical conclusions from their ability to beat the market that therefore maybe the market isn't so right. I mean, the one thing Buffett and Soros make money in – well – I'm sure Soros has made money in lots of different ways, but if you look at sort of the general approach, Buffett's approach is all about the market being irrational but always tending back towards rationality, so things will eventually pay off for him, whereas Soros is about the market being irrational and finding situations where the market's likely to get even crazier. I mean, finding cases where there's momentum and piling on has generally been – I mean, I think in recent years he's also bet against – such things, but what made him his billions was betting that a panic in the British pound would continue.
And there's a character we haven't mentioned, but that's a terrible oversight. Michael Jensen, who was a theoretician with a large real world influence. So,
and so few people seem to get that. I mean, that was one of the – I end up quoting you in my book because you have this great quote about Jensenism being this all-encompassing unified field theory of how the world works, where basically all you need is markets steering corporate executives to behave in the right way and set up the incentives within companies correctly so that executives have to obey the market, and then everything's going to work. You don't need regulation. You don't need anything. And Jensen's fascinating to me because he's another one of those people who – He had these really extreme beliefs in the 80s and early 90s, and he still has just this extremist manner about him. But he's looked at reality and realized that things didn't work quite the way he prescribed.
But no, if we go back to what he was writing in the 70s and early 80s, you know, he thought the traditional corporation was an obsolete form. Managers had too easy a time of it. They just got fat. They had too many perks. And the thing to do was to take them over. Takeover artists should borrow lots and lots of money and take over corporations. And
right, because his initial argument had been that the efficient market should be the perfect discipline. The stock market should be the perfect discipline for corporate executives. And then over the course of the 70s, sort of realizing that most executives didn't pay that much attention to the stock market because at that point they weren't really being paid in stock or options to a great extent. And so then he pushed this. He's the big intellectual backer of leveraged buyouts, and also the big intellectual backer of paying people with lots of stock options.
And now he's changed his mind again, hasn't he?
Yeah, but I mean, and being Jensen, he'll never quite admit to changing it completely. But now he together with Werner Erhard of Est fame, which is just so wonderfully bizarre, have this ever-growing paper. The last version of it I looked at is about 120 pages long, trying to incorporate the idea of integrity, that if you have integrity, then everything works, that if you set up this system where people have to behave in integrity, as they put it, which basically means not lying, well, delivering – it's really delivering what you say you're going to deliver, and then the second you realize you can't deliver it, admitting it.
So no more Ken Lays or Bernie Madoffs.
Right. But what I'm not clear about, and maybe Mike and Werner have figured this out in the past few months and I just haven't heard about it, I don't know how they enforce that. I don't know how you make sure that CEOs behave like that.
We've only got a minute or so left, but including question, we talked some about how the Chicago doctrine that the market is always right had an enormous political cultural effect. Now I think people are recognizing that the market is far from always right, not only academics but lots of practical
right.
sorts. Have we drawn any political conclusions from that, or are we still just wandering in the wilderness uncertain?
It seems like we're still wandering. And one of the fascinating things in this, and another character in the book who we didn't bring up, is Larry Summers, who was in the early 80s one of the big critics of the rational market idea. And yet somehow he generally seems to think financial markets should be restored to their, maybe not quite the role they played in the last few years, but he doesn't want to shut it all down.
Well, and that's interesting. He spent some time working for a hedge fund, made $5 million for a day a week's work.
But he had made this switch in the late 90s when he was still getting paid government wages.
But he also advised Harvard to leverage up its portfolio, and now they're having to borrow to pay operating expenses. But Larry Summers seems to be doing okay. So do you think the politics of this is going to change?
I got to think the next few years aren't going to be great economically, and that there are going to be more strange financial things that happen. I don't necessarily think it has to be like last fall again. I sure hope not. But I get the feeling that there's going to be continuing political pressure in the next few years on this issue. But I really don't know. I don't think anybody the problem is there isn't any widely accepted alternative view of how the world works that then leads you very quickly to, oh, this is how regulation should work. This is what we should do.
All right. Well, that's the research agenda for the future. I've been speaking with Justin Fox, who is the author of the book, The Myth of the Rational Market, The History of Risk, Reward, and Delusion on Wall Street, just out from Harper. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week. And let's go out with this from Miss Kitten, Stock Exchange Woman. Till next week. Bye.